May it please the court, my name is Mike Zweibel. I am here representing Linda and Stephen Castle, the plaintiffs and appellants.
Apologize for mispronouncing your name.
Oh, no, that's why everybody does.
Okay.
In German, it's Zweibel, so it's a common mistake. Your Honors, this case presents four issues. I'm going to be focusing on the fee-shifting provision issues, which started out the briefs, but of course I'm happy to address any of the other issues that the court would like me to address. I think the general rules governing fee-shifting provisions tell us a lot about how to proceed here. Fee-shifting provisions are in derogation of the general rule that each party is to bear their own fees and costs in an action. Because of that, fee-shifting provisions are narrowly and strictly construed, and attorney's fees can only be awarded if the fee-shifting provision plainly and unambiguously permits the award of the fees. In this case, not only does the fee-shifting provision not plainly and unambiguously permit the fees, in fact, it seems to plainly and unambiguously exclude the fees, with except for a very small portion, that were awarded here.
Go ahead. I was going to ask, before we get to the merits, there is an issue as to whether or not this issue is adequately preserved. And I think there may be a slight difference between the parties as to what is the standard for whether we get to a plain error. We don't usually do plain error on the civil side. And what is your understanding what the standard is for our undertaking a plain error review?
My understanding, first of all, is that it is a discretionary matter with the court, but that the Supreme Court recently, in two cases, has set out basically four criteria that the court is to look at in determining whether to grant plain error review. And I think, and I know there's also talk about manifest injustice and affecting reliability of the judgment. I'll get to that in a moment. I don't think it's a simple yes or no answer. Here's the standard. Boom.
Sure.
I think that the court basically considered four factors in the two cases that we cited at length in the briefs in determining whether to grant plain error review, and we've touched all the bases here. We have met every single one of those criteria.
I have a question about one of the criteria, which is that the party raising the issue opposed the ruling, though not on the specific grounds asserted on appeal. My understanding is that in the trial court, your client opposed imposing legal fees based on Section 13.17.102 and also opposed the amount of the fees, but I didn't understand them to be opposing the imposition of fees based on the language of the contract clause.
Well, I think when we look at those two cases, the two Supreme Court cases, and also here, what the court's really talking about is opposing the ultimate result. Here, and in those cases, you oppose the ultimate result of awarding attorney's fees, even if you don't oppose it on the specific ground that's later raised on appeal. And so the bottom line here was that the plaintiffs, through their trial counsel, opposed the award of attorney's fees. And so I think they did fit the criteria for opposing the relief requested.
I understand that the defendant did assert fees based both on 13.17.102 and the clause.
Yes.
And here, I understand you're saying the ultimate result of imposing fees was opposed, but nothing was said about the alternative ground of the contract clause.
Now, obviously, I can't speak for trial counsel and
I understand that.
Raised, but I do know that having made that argument, trial counsel asked for the court to award no attorney's fees, and the trial counsel could not have done that if trial counsel thought that the award was justified under the contract. So the trial court knew the trial counsel was opposing, plaintiffs through their trial counsel were opposing the award of attorney's fees.
Counsel, you indicated, I think, correctly, that it's discretionary for this court when it comes to plain error. So let me ask you what the manifest injustice is in this case.
The manifest injustice is the award of attorney's fees.
Why?
I think the, as I put that in the briefs, the term-
Amount of the fees or the fees, any fees?
The fees incurred in defense against the plaintiff's actions. I think there is one claim, which is the counterclaim, for which LT is entitled to attorney's fees, because that was a counterclaim for breach of contract, and that falls within the language of the clause. The evidence on that was extremely limited. It was basically, they didn't pay the last invoice, and the plaintiff saying, here's why we didn't pay the last invoice.
Well, what did the plaintiff say? Why didn't they pay the last invoice?
You know,
because the work was defective?
I was not trial counsel, but right. I can tell you that what happened was they said we did this on advice of counsel. Counsel told us not to do it because we were owed more than the amount of this invoice. In other words, I agreed with that advice.
In order for the defendant to prevail on the counterclaim, didn't they have to overcome the plaintiff's claims that there was defective work? I mean, isn't that in effect what you're saying?
I don't think so, because that was their claim. That was the plaintiff's argument about why they didn't pay it. But in fact, I think, quite frankly, that money was owed regardless. I don't think there's anything that allows self-help. You can't just withhold a payment on the ground that you're now going to seek damages that may or may not be awarded, that may be greater.
From the trial court standpoint, the trial court may have viewed this as a case where you can't award a counterclaim for work done if the work is defective. And the plaintiffs were arguing all the way through the trial that the work was defective, were they not?
Well, I think the proof is in the jury instructions here. The jury was never instructed that plaintiffs could prevail on the breach of counterclaim if the other party was had performed defective work. The claims were severable and considered separately. And so I don't think that was necessary to overcome the plaintiff's case.
To go back to my question about manifest injustice, you said the attorney's fees are manifest injustice. And then my colleague Judge Richmond asked you which part, the amount, the fact of, your response to that?
Yes, it is the fact of attorney's fees, except for attorney's fees attributable to the counterclaim for breach of contract. And the reason the cases really talk about manifest injustice and affecting the reliability of the judgment interchangeably. As a matter of fact, if you look at Robinson and the other Supreme Court cases, name escapes me at the moment, they never use the term manifest injustice in discussing whether to apply plain error review. They talk about affecting the reliability of the judgment. And for that, I think the most salient fact is whether the trial court relied on the erroneous legal ruling to reach its judgment. And that's precisely what happened here. The sole basis on which attorney fees were awarded here was on the contractual language. And so if that analysis is wrong, then the judgment is wrong. And so it's not as if this is a sub-issue, as if we have to go through a lot of inferential steps to talk about how it affected the judgment. It is the judgment. And so it is, for that reason, I think, a very appropriate case for plain error review. I also want to mention, in terms of the preservation argument, which I mentioned in the briefs and I think is important, that LT has asked this court for attorney's fees based on the contract in this appeal. And I don't see how it's possible for the court to make that determination without construing the contractual language in exactly the manner we've asked it to do. And it is de novo. That's another factor that the courts consider in plain error review. And so I don't think LT can ask this court, please construe the contractual language to give us attorney's fees on this appeal, but at the same time, don't apply that analysis to the underlying substantive issue. And the court will have done that de novo review just in order to address LT's attorney fee claim on appeal. And so I do think the court gets to this issue, or I would respectfully suggest that it should get to this issue, that this is an issue that was brought to the attention of the trial court, that the trial court analyzed, that the trial court ruled on. And so there's no reason, really, for this court not to address this. And I don't think, frankly, I don't think Mr. and Mrs. Castle ought to be punished for the oversight of their trial counsel in failing to recognize this issue. And I think once we do get to this issue, it's really not a difficult interpretation because the language is very straightforward. The language says, in the event of default by either party hereunder, and if it should be necessary for the party not in default to employ an attorney to enforce the provisions thereof. So clearly talking about an enforcement action, we're talking about the party instituting the action against the party that's in breach. And I think there's no way to have that apply to the defense of actions without torturing that language beyond recognition. I think the words have to mean something and what they refer to. And this was LT's contract. And when it's put in there for the protection of both parties and limits the exposure of both parties.
By virtue of the counterclaim judgment, it was found that the Castles breached the contract, right? They are a breaching party of the contract. You concede that in terms of the counterclaim.
Yeah, on that claim.
All right. So they had to retain an attorney to deal with an alleged default under the contract. And in Wheeler, which you say doesn't apply, but I'm not quite sure why you say that, the same situation occurred. The defendant there recovered attorney's fees, not just for pursuing his counterclaim, but as I read the case, for the costs he incurred in defending plaintiff's claim for damages.
The reason Wheeler doesn't apply is because this issue was never raised in Wheeler. I reread Wheeler this morning on the way over because I wanted to be sure. I probably read it 50 times trying to prepare this brief because I am puzzled by the insistence of the trial court and by LT that Wheeler applies here. And I continue to be puzzled by that. Wheeler was a prevailing party issue. Both parties claimed entitlement to attorney's fees. Neither party disputed what the language meant in that case. The issue simply was never before the court. And so
language of the contract in Wheeler isn't substantially different from the language in the contract in this case.
Well, it doesn't matter what the contract said in Wheeler because that language, first of all, I dispute that the language is virtually identical, but I don't think we need to get there because in Wheeler, the parties never raised and the court never addressed the issue of whether or not the scope of that language included the defense of claims or non-contractual claims. And I do want to make sure to mention that that is our alternative position here, that this applies only to contractual and not to non-contractual claims. But in Wheeler, the court never addressed it. I'm trying to find the part where they address it. It doesn't happen because both parties are claiming entitlement to attorney's fees. And so the only thing the court sorted out in Wheeler was who the prevailing party was.
Ultimately allowing the defendant to recover his cost of defense.
Because the issue was never raised. I mean, I think the court, sua sponte, says, oh, by the way, we've taken a look at this language and we don't think it says what everybody below seemed to think it said. So Wheeler just simply doesn't solve this issue. I also point out that the Wheeler language is a little different because it talks about attorney's fees incident to any action to enforce. And I don't think we need to get there, but the language incident to is a little like arising out of or relating to, which was found to be sort of much broader in some of the cases that I cited in the brief. We don't have any of that broad language in this case. And so if the court doesn't have any questions right at the moment, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Please the court. My name is Trevor Kofer, registration number 31356. I'm here today along with Robin Lamborn, attorney registration number 39875. With respect to the attorney's fees argument that you just heard from appellant's counsel, the appellants did not preserve issues on appeal. The court has alluded to this fact already. The appellants simply did not preserve the issues that they're raising now with respect to the attorney's fees issue on appeal. And the appellate court cannot consider new arguments that were not presented to the trial court. That's what the Stevenson versus Hollywood Bar and Cafe case said, found at 832 Pacific 2nd, 718, a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1992.
as Mr. Zoybell points out, there is the Robinson case, which as we have, we can't exercise our discretion in the face of manifest injustice, even though Robinson may say that, the Court of Appeals cases say that, we can't exercise our discretion to consider the arguments that they're now trying to raise. So why don't you tell us why we shouldn't?
You bet. There is no manifest injustice in this particular case. The cases that relate to the manifest injustice that have been cited on the briefs really relate to constitutional concerns, criminal concerns. Manifest injustice is rarely exercised in the civil context. We would articulate from the appellee's position that the invited error doctrine applies here as opposed to the plain error rule, as there is no manifest injustice here. This particular case and the fee-shifting provision in the contract applies to parties who engage in a contract at arm's-length transaction. They both agree that the party in default would be responsible to pay all reasonable attorney's fees. That's what the contract says. It's very broad language as opposed to what appellant's counsel says. There is no manifest injustice here. We're not talking about a broad group of parties that are going to be adversely affected by a constitutional issue in this particular case. We're talking about an applicable provision set forth in the contract. Under the invited error doctrine, it applies where a party urged the lower court to adopt a ruling or expressly acquiesced to the ruling. Plaintiff's counsel at the trial court level never articulated that the attorney's fee shifting provision did not apply. He only addressed the reasonableness of the fees. If you look at the response brief that was filed to LT Builder's motion for attorney's fees at the district court level, the attorney conceded, plaintiff's counsel conceded, that the construction agreement allows for an award of, quote, reasonable attorney fees, end quote. That was conceded at the trial court level. The sum and substance of the argument that was articulated only related to the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. There was never any argument about whether or not that particular clause actually applied. As such, that issue has not been preserved for appeal, as the plaintiff's attorney essentially invited the error at the trial court level.
Things I'm still confused about is whether they're given their concession, I think, that LT is entitled to recover fees under the contract, had it been under the contract, for the counterclaim. Why aren't all their fees for defending the case recoverable under the contract language?
Your Honor,
could you have recovered on the counterclaim without disproving the claims of defective construction?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In fact, if you look at the language of the express counterclaim, the jury instruction that related to the breach of contract claim, paragraph number 3, and this is all in the record, says the counterclaim plaintiff LT Builders substantially performed its part of the contract. Did LT Builders substantially perform its part of the contract? Incident to that is exactly what you're alluding to. That is whether or not LT Builders defectively built this property. So if you look at the Wheeler case, it's already been referenced in today's argument. LT Builders is entitled to its attorney's fees, not only for the prosecution of its counterclaim, but also for defending the plaintiff's claims relative to the alleged construction defects of the property as set forth.
As I understand what you say in your brief, and I haven't read every bit of the record yet, the construction defect claims, the breach of contract claims, the breach of warranty claims were not dropped out of this case until at the conclusion of the trial?
That's essentially correct, Your Honor. This case was litigated for about 6 years on several breach of contract theories. The breach of contract for negligent and defective construction was how the initial claim was titled as it related to LT Builders. This case was essentially a breach of contract claim for 6 years, and right before the case was submitted to the jury, plaintiff's counsel converted this case to a simple negligence claim.
Oh, did he do that? What happened? What happened? They stood up and they said, we're dismissing our breach of contract claims. We only want to go to the jury on negligence claims?
That was essentially it, Your Honor. They wanted to convert the breach of contract claims to negligence claims. Maybe it was a standard issue. I'm not exactly certain what the rationale was behind why plaintiffs decided to convert the case from a breach of contract claim to a negligence claim.
Negligence claims not asserted until that point?
There was a negligence supervision claim, I believe, it was asserted in the complaint initially, Your Honor. And the way the case was styled was breach of contract for negligent and defective construction. So we had the contract that provided the standard for the work to be done, and then it was a negligent breach of that contract that was articulated in the complaint against LT Builders. That's how it was styled in the complaint.
So the comparative negligence claims came in as a result of a negligent supervision claim that was already there, or the new negligence theory?
That's the question, is, well, Your Honor. I think the comparative fault instruction might have come in relative to the negligence supervision, but it certainly came in when the plaintiffs converted the claims to a negligence claim. Absolutely.
Objection to claims being asserted?
There was not, Your Honor.
Is there an objection to the comparative fault being sought by the defendants?
No, there was not, Your Honor. That goes to another issue. The plaintiff did not preserve review on that particular issue. Rule 51 of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure required any objection to any jury instructions must be submitted prior to the instructions being given to the jury, and that the appellate court reviewing any instructions or any appeal issues has to only look at issues that have been preserved and the grounds preserved prior to the jury instructions being submitted to the jury.
They did file a Rule 59 motion for J&OV, which I gather defendants let's see if I get the parties right. Defendant opposed, right?
Well, I don't think that undoes what has already been done, Your Honor. Rule 51 is in advance of a post-trial motion set forth in Rule 59. Rule 51 provides explicitly that any objections to jury instructions be made before the instructions are submitted. A Rule 59 motion that was filed is a backdoor attempt essentially to undo what had failed to be done before the instructions were submitted to the jury.
Let me take that in two bites. Certainly they could have filed the Rule 59 that says there wasn't evidence to support the jury's conclusion that there was comparative negligence. That the court could review post-trial, right?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And your position is that there was evidence to support the jury's finding of comparative negligence here.
That is true, Your Honor.
I detailed that in your brief.
Sure.
But could they have said on a J&OV, as a matter of law, comparative negligence never should have been submitted to the jury, even though they didn't file an objection to the jury instructions?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe CRCP is dispositive of this issue. Any objections regarding a jury instruction have to be presented before they're submitted to the jury. And only the bases, only the grounds raised at that instance can be then reviewed by the appellate court.
And in this case, perhaps they could have done it by some kind of a motion in limine, but the idea of comparative negligence didn't come up until just at the time of the jury instructions when all these events happened.
I think that issue had been contemplated by the parties because there were some claims that were couched in terms of negligence apart from the breach of contract claim that was converted to a simple negligence claim before that. So whether or not that was contemplated, I believe that it probably was. It certainly was contemplated in the jury instructions that were ultimately submitted to the jury for its consideration.
There was never an opposition by a plaintiff whatsoever to the comparative negligence instruction.
No, that was not, Your Honor. It was not preserved for purposes of appeal.
Okay.
With respect to this issue on the attorney's fees award, plaintiff's counsel had filed their response brief in opposition to LT Builder's request for attorney's fees. There was a hearing about 9 months later on this particular issue with Judge Williams at the district court level. Plaintiff's counsel had an opportunity to present any additional arguments he might have wanted to assert with respect to whether the fee shifting provision actually applied. Did not do that. Never made that argument that the fee shifting provision did not apply, simply was not preserved for appeal. The appellant's counsel has raised an argument about whether or not the verdict was consistent or not. That issue hasn't been addressed specifically yet before this panel. Frankly, the plaintiffs have a very high burden to overcome the verdict of the jury. A reviewing court cannot reverse a jury's verdict for inconsistency if a reading of the record reveals any basis for the verdict. The question is whether there was competent evidence from which a jury could have logically reached its verdict. And frankly, the verdict rendered by the jury in this case was very clear on this point.
I have a question about that.
Sure.
Dry land was found to be negligent, and dry land was found to be a cause of plaintiff's damages. When we get to the question 48, I think it is, no percentage was allocated to dry land. So how can a party be a cause of damages and have no 0% allocated to it? Now, I understand your position. One of your positions is that it turns out in the trial, prior to trial, Dryland settled with the plaintiff. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And evidence of that settlement was actually put into evidence by plaintiff's representative before the jury for some reason.
That is correct, Your Honor. Mrs. Castle testified at trial that Dryland stucco was asked to come back after their property to make repairs to the stucco. That's exactly what happened.
She testified in effect that, well, therefore we were satisfied or the damages were ameliorated or something to that effect?
She did testify that, in fact, that the work that was performed by Dryland stucco with the property did reduce the adverse effect of the rodent infestation problem as it was alleged at trial.
At that point, then, Hylan was on the jury verdict simply as a non-party at fault, is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So is it true that any percentage of negligence, had any percentage of negligence been allocated to Drylan, it would have only had the effect of reducing the damages LT would have paid. It wouldn't have affected the plaintiff by that time because she and he had already settled with Drylan, right?
I believe that's the intent of 1321.111.5, Your Honor, to reduce the responsibility of the defendant on the same side of the V.
So even
doesn't that constitute speculation? If the jury had thought that they had to assign, say they assigned 4% fault to Drylan, couldn't they have taken 2% off of each of them?
They could have, Your Honor. We don't know that. We're talking about speculation with respect to what the jury may have done. If they had done that, the intention behind what the jury did was very clear. They attributed 50% fault to the plaintiffs. They attributed 50% of the fault to LT Builders. In a 50-50 tie, defense wins, plaintiffs lose. Not only that, but the verdict form specifically says that if the plaintiff's fault is equal to or greater than that of the defendant's, that is 50% or more, don't go to the next question. What's the next question in the verdict form? It relates exclusively to damages. That's the next section of the verdict forms.
That apply if there's a tie 48-48?
If there was a tie 48-48, the jury instruction said 50-50. So if the plaintiff's negligence was 48%, if LT's was 48%,
she says if the plaintiff's negligence is equal to or greater than the combined negligence of the defendant and non-parties.
That's correct. The combined negligence of either the defendants, non-parties, etc. Yes. Did that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
So the jury's verdict was consistent. It was clear from the verdict forms that they intended the plaintiffs not receive anything in this case. Not only that, but awarding LT Builders the full amount of the counterclaim that was asked, $33,029.27, also, I think, affirms the intent of the jury's verdicts in this particular instance. Also, with respect to Drylan issue, really quick, there was no evidence that was presented with respect to the amount of damage, to value the damage that was repaired by Drylan stucco. I think it would be reasonable for a jury to conclude that because Drylan stucco had come out of the property and made these repairs, that the item of damage would no longer be relevant. The issues that had been identified on the stucco problem had been taken care of. Therefore, the jury had no reason to allocate any portion of damages to the non-party at fault. That issue was already taken care of.
Did answer yes to the question, was the negligence of Dryland stucco a cause of damage to the plaintiffs?
It did, Your Honor. And I think the logical rationale behind that was that they had heard evidence at trial that the repairs that were made by Dryland stucco were effective. And there was no distinction between present damage, past damage. There was no distinction with respect to that issue. So the jury could have concluded that because the repairs were made, that resolved the issues with respect to that issue.
There are a number of cases. There are a couple of cases out there that reconcile inconsistent verdicts, and I think you cited one. But say, yes, there can be negligence, but the negligence doesn't necessarily cause damage. But those cases don't necessarily help us here because it says there was negligence, and it says the negligence caused damages, but then it gave 0% to Drylan. Is there any case, something like this, where post-claim evidence comes in and it explains the jury's verdict, even though it doesn't deal with the damage at the time the claims were filed? Did you ever find any case like that?
You know, not that I recall, Your Honor.
Hi.
Under Rule 51, the plaintiffs did not preserve issues with respect to the jury instructions that were submitted to the jury for purposes of appeal, not only with respect to the issues on the verdict forms with Drylan stucco, but also on the attorney's fees issue. There were never any objections that were made contemporaneous prior to the jury instructions being made. The jury did not have to find any damages as an element of negligence, and that might be another issue that you were trying to get at a little bit. The jury instructions were a little bit strange. They asked for a finding of negligence, causation, and then below that, damages. So just because the jury found negligence and causation didn't mean that they necessarily had to find damages.
This is right out of the form instructions, CJ.
That's correct.
It's form 928D, I think, right?
Correct.
It says cause damages. Didn't say cause injury.
Cause damages, yes, Your Honor. We request that the relief that was requested in the answer brief be allowed by this court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Well, I have a lot of new issues to talk about. I'll try and do it in 80 seconds. With regard to the dry land issue, the testimony was not that dry land had repaired all of the damages attributable to the faulty stucco. They closed some gaps. But for example, there was no flashing put in the stucco, and as a result, there was water damage to the frame of the home, which would eventually rot the entire home. That was one of the main elements of damages. It was testified to by the expert. It was not fixed by Dryland, and it was Dryland's responsibility because they were the people who put the stucco in. So to say that, well, you know, they did some repairs and that's the end of it, is, I don't think it's correct. With regard to the jury's findings, they...
Dryland was only in there as a non-party at fault, right? Correct. If it's settled. So any negligence attributable to Dryland only would have reduced the damage that the defendant would have been liable for otherwise.
But as Judge Miller pointed out, it is speculative to think of where the jury would have taken those percentages from. The jury here, I think, was completely confused by these instructions, and you can see it throughout the verdict. There are inconsistencies with regard to the pool as well that we talk about. And I think the fact that the jury assigned 50-50 without thinking what percentage went to dry land, I don't think we can speculate that they necessarily would have taken that percentage only off of LT Builders, that if they had actually properly applied it and thought about which damages went to dry land, that may have reduced the plaintiff's damages as well.
Thank you, counsel. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It could have been 4%, 46%, 50%.
It could have been, but because it's speculative, I don't think we can go there. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, both of you, for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and we'll render a decision in due course.